You're listening to Crossing the Line, a weekly podcast dedicated to giving voice to the voiceless in occupied Palestine. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
This week on Crossing the Line.
What we've seen is a very similar picture to what we've seen some 2 years ago when we initially released the figures of our monitoring effort, and that is that some 10% of the investigations do result in an indictment. Or to put it in another way, 90% of the investigations basically fail.
During the years 2000 through 2007, of the nearly 1,300 investigations by the Israeli military police into suspected offenses against Palestinians committed by the IOF, only 76 ended in indictments. In our first segment, Lior Yavne, research director of the Israeli human rights group, Yesh Din, will join us to discuss these disturbing statistics. Also this week,
We were well guided. we were herded. And, you know, you developed a herd mentality. You just sort of follow the leader and believe what is said. But then, you know, I backed into a change.
He once proclaimed to be a staunch Christian Zionist and a true friend to Israel. He exhorted his congregation to pray God's blessings upon the state. But in 1990, the Reverend Thomas R. had a reawakening and became an outspoken supporter of Palestinian human rights and a fierce critic of Israeli occupation. He'll join us today to talk about his profound conversion and his new mission in life. All that and more coming up. But first, the news from Palestine.
This Week in Palestine, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for August 2nd through August 8th, 2008. Israeli Defense Minister Ehud Barak stated his belief on Thursday that a peace agreement between Palestinians and Israelis is unlikely by the end of this year, as a Palestinian ceasefire with Israel enters its seventh week. Death toll in Gaza reaches 227. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. We begin our weekly report with recent nonviolent actions in the West Bank. IMEMC's Rola Shahwan has the details.
On Monday morning, Palestinian medical sources in the central West Bank city of Ramallah told IMEMC that 17-year-old Yusuf Amira, who was shot in the nearby Nil'in village on Wednesday evening, had been pronounced dead. Amira was among the villagers who took part in the funeral of Ahmed Musa, the 11-year-old Palestinian boy who was killed by the Israeli army gunfire earlier on Tuesday night. As soon as the funeral on Wednesday afternoon was finished, local youth clashed with the Israeli soldiers. Amira was among the three who were injured. On Thursday, a group of peace activists, including internationals and local villagers, marched in a nonviolent protest against the wall at Nil'in village near the southern West Bank city of Ramallah. Israeli army soldiers attacked the protesters. During clashes, three protesters were injured by soldiers firing rubber-coated steel bullets and dozens suffered from CS gas inhalation. The Israeli army kidnapped two members from the local popular committee against the wall and settlement construction. The Israeli army dispersed the weekly nonviolent protest located at Bel'in village, north of the West Bank city of Ramallah, on Friday midday with gas, guns and grenades, local sources reported. After the weekly Friday prayer, a group of 300 internationals and peace activists marched in nonviolent protest in solidarity with the people of Bel'in village. The protest was against the illegal wall being built on the village lands. The protesters were demonstrating against the Israeli killings of local civilians as well as the illegal closures and confiscations of lands and property. The protesters walked toward the wall with the intention of reaching the villagers' land behind it. Israeli troops shot CS gas canisters, rubber-coated steel bullets, and concussion grenades at the protesters. A number of civilians reported suffering from gas inhalation, and for the first time, Israeli troops threw manure at the protesters. A group of 150 nonviolent protesters marched in a protest against the illegal wall on Friday midday at Al-Khadr village nearby the West Bank city of Bethlehem. IMEMC correspondents reported that the protest took place after the Friday prayer at the village. The demonstrators marched in protest against the apartheid wall being built on the village lands. Israeli troops stopped the protest by shooting tear gas and sand bombs at the protesters, causing two civilians to suffer from gas inhalation. Moreover, on Friday, the Israeli army attacked the weekly nonviolent protests at Al-Masara village, southern the West Bank city of Bethlehem. A group of internationals, peace activists, and villagers marched in protest against the illegal wall being built on the village lands. The protesters headed towards the wall. Israeli troops attacked the protesters by shooting grenades, gunfire, and tear gas, causing many to suffer from gas inhalation. For IMEMC.org, this is Rula Shahwan.
Israeli Defense Minister Ehud Barak stated his belief on Thursday that a peace agreement between Palestinians and Israelis is unlikely by the end of this year. Barak had earlier hinted at the possibility of carrying out a large-scale military offensive on the Gaza Strip. This and more by IMEMC's Kendra Poirier.
Barak's remarks are contrary to outspoken optimism by other Israeli and Palestinian officials over the weekend, as the meeting between Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert and Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas reiterated the two sides' willingness to hold more talks for the sake of an agreement. Palestinian negotiator Saeb Erekat told reporters on Wednesday following the leaders' meeting in West Jerusalem that the two parties agreed to continue talks over outstanding issues until they reach an accord. Israeli and Palestinian negotiators held a new round of talks in Washington this week in hopes of seeing an agreement on the two-state solution before President George W. Bush's term in office comes to an end in January 2009. Erekat revealed that Israel agreed to release 150 Palestinian prisoners with long-term sentences and chronic diseases. Earlier this week, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas held talks with Jordanian King Abdullah II in Amman. The two leaders discussed the need for peace in the region based on the two-state solution envisioned by Washington. Among the contentious issues of negotiations are the continued Israeli settlement activities on occupied Palestinian lands, the status of East Jerusalem, the problem of Palestinian refugees, and the borders of Palestinian state. Israel's drive towards settlement activities might negate the Palestinians' right to a sovereign Palestinian state within the borders of 1967, which includes the entire West Bank region, the occupied East Jerusalem, and the Gaza Strip. Meanwhile, the ruling Hamas party in Gaza slammed the recent Abbas-Olmert meeting as a waste of time only helpful to Israeli Prime Minister Olmert, who is facing corruption charges that would topple him. Hamas, which lies under strict Israeli blockade, also urged President Abbas to restart a stalled dialogue with the Hamas party instead. Earlier this week, rivalry between Hamas and Fatah reached a climax, with Hamas using arms against a Fatah-linked clan in Gaza City and finally forcing more than 150 members of such a family out of Israeli territories. Abbas of Fatah in turn reiterated his demand to Hamas that the party should renounce control over Gaza following the Saturday's clash with Fatah-allied people. Since 2006 parliamentary elections, both Fatah and Hamas have been at loggerheads until the democratically elected Islamic Hamas party took over Gaza completely and ejected Fatah-loyal security forces in June 2007. Over the past 14 months, Israel has placed the coastal enclave under a strict military blockade and has carried out sporadic attacks on Palestinian resistance groups there involving the governing Hamas. For IMEMC, this is Kendra Purrier.
As the Palestinian ceasefire with Israel enters its seventh week, the death toll in Gaza Strip reaches 227. This and more from IMEMC's Rami El-Mighari in Gaza.
In the Gaza Strip, the number of patients who have died due to the Israeli siege has reached 227, as one more patient dies this week. Medical sources pronounce the death of 53-year-old Suad Abu Rabuh, who died of cancer. She was not able to leave the Gaza Strip to receive life-saving medical treatment. In addition, Palestinian security sources told media outlets that Israeli gunboats fired at fishermen in the Sudania area in northern Gaza and in the city of Khan Yunis in the south. No casualties were reported. Since the outbreak of the Al-Aqsa Intifada in September 2000, more than 5,000 Palestinian fishermen have been exposed to nearly constant harassment by Israeli naval forces. Israeli army has continued to close all border crossings of the Gaza Strip for more than 1 year and a half. The total siege imposed by the Israeli army on the Gaza Strip has left disastrous impacts on the humanitarian situation and has violated the economic and social rights of the nearly 1.5 million Palestinian civilian residents, particularly the rights to appropriate living conditions, health and education. Furthermore, severe restrictions have been imposed on the movement of the Palestinian civilian population. The siege imposed on the Gaza Strip has severely impacted the flow of food, medical supplies and other necessities such as fuel, construction materials and raw materials for various economic sectors. Israeli forces have continued to prevent the entry of raw materials into the Gaza Strip, and subsequently, manufacturers have stopped their industrial activities. For IMEMC.org, this is Rami Al-Mighari in Gaza.
Israeli forces killed a Palestinian civilian in Na'aleen village west of Ramallah. In addition, two Palestinian civilians were wounded by the Israeli gunfire. During 38 invasions into Palestinian communities in the West Bank, Israeli forces kidnapped 49 Palestinians, including three children. IMEMC's William Bascom had the details.
This week's attacks were focused in the cities of Nablus, Hebron, Jenin, and Ramallah. The number of Palestinian civilians kidnapped by the Israeli army in the West Bank since the beginning of the year now stands at 1,718. On Monday morning, Palestinian medical sources in the central West Bank city of Ramallah told IMEMC that 17-year-old Yusuf Amira, who was shot in the nearby Nil'in village on Wednesday evening, had been pronounced dead. Amira was among the villagers who took part in the funeral of Ahmad Musa, the 11-year-old Palestinian boy who was killed by Israeli army gunfire the previous Tuesday night. Following the funeral on Wednesday afternoon, local youth clashed with Israeli soldiers. Amira was among the three who were injured during the clash. Also on Monday, the Israeli army invaded Al-Farah refugee camp south of Tubas. Israeli troops besieged a house belonging to the family of Yusuf Mohammed Sarhan, 27. Soon after, Israeli military vehicles moved into the camp to support the Israeli army. Israeli soldiers called through megaphones for Sarhan and his family to get out. The family followed the orders, which resulted in Israeli troops kidnapping Sarhan. Israeli soldiers then moved into the house and searched it, confiscating two computer sets. On Tuesday, a group of Israeli settlers attacked the West Bank city of Hebron. Eyewitnesses reported that the Israeli settlers attacked Palestinian cars by throwing stones. Settlers also attacked several houses in Wad al-Nasara village in an attempt to break in. Also in the village of Wad al-Nasara, medical sources reported that Israeli settlers attacked 80-year-old Aish al-Jabri, who sustained moderate injuries and bruising. He was transported to a local hospital for treatment. Israeli forces have continued to impose severe restrictions on the movement of Palestinian civilians in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, including occupied East Jerusalem. During the reporting period, Israeli troops positioned themselves at various military checkpoints in the West Bank and kidnapped four Palestinian civilians. For IMEMC.org, this is William Bascom.
And this is just some of the news this week in Palestine. For constant updates, check our website www.imemc.org. Thanks for joining us from Occupied Bethlehem. This week's report was brought to you by George Shmawi and Hussam Kassis.
In Berkeley, I'm Najee Ali, and you're listening to Crossing the Line. Only 6% of probes into offenses allegedly committed by Israeli soldiers against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank yield indictments. Of a total of 1,246 investigations by the military police into suspected offenses against Palestinians or Palestinian property between 2000 and 2007, only 76 ended in indictments. This report comes as the IOF is investigating the death of a 12-year-old Palestinian boy, Ahmed Musa, in the village of Nil'in, who was allegedly shot in the head by IOF troops during a protest against the illegal apartheid wall on July 29th. On July 21st, a 27-year-old Palestinian man was shot in the foot at point-blank range by an IOF soldier. The man was blindfolded and handcuffed and in IOF custody at the time. The incident was captured on tape. With us from Tel Aviv to speak more about these disturbing statistics is Lior Yavne, the research director of Yesh Din, a group formed in March of 2005 to oppose the continuing violation of Palestinian human rights in the occupied territories. Lior Yavne, welcome to Crossing the Line.
Thank you very much.
Lior, only 6% of probes into offenses allegedly committed by the Israeli Defense Force against Palestinians in the West Bank yielded indictments. Are these figures inclusive of indictments that have been caught on tape, or are they just talking about ones that haven't been?
These figures are inclusive of pretty much all indictments filed between 2000 or September 29, 2000 till the end of 2007. We were able to get hold of all copies of all indictments, which the IDF spokesperson unit has passed to us. Comparing the figures for the total number of investigations and the number of indictments, we learned that throughout these 7 years, there were only 6% of the investigation files that turned into indictments. We're talking about 132 soldiers and officers that were in fact indicted following these 76 investigation files. Most of those indicted were eventually, most of those indicted were found guilty of various offenses, and only four were fully acquitted. However, the very low number of indictments following all these investigations suggest there is practically a culture of impunity within the Israeli army when it comes to safeguarding the human rights of Palestinians.
Now, these figures only talk about the West Bank. If it's this bad there, how worse off are the Palestinians in Gaza who really don't have any way of getting out this kinds of information to organizations such as yours and others?
Well, actually, these figures are inclusive of the Gaza Strip as well. As I said, these figures relate to all indictments or all investigation files regarding offenses against Palestinians and their property since the beginning of the Second Intifada. We did not compile separate statistics for the Gaza Strip, but I think it can be seen from what I've seen so far that most of these investigations are launched following incidents in the West Bank. There may be a number of reasons to that, but we did not complete the research on this area yet.
Now, on the day that 12-year-old Ahmed Musa was shot in the head in Nilin, the commander of the unit in which a blindfolded and handcuffed Palestinian man was shot while the commander was holding on to the man was suspended for 10 days after he failed a lie detector test. Lior, what are we to make of this when someone is caught on tape with this sort of evidence? It's projected all around the world, and all that happens to him is a 10-day cut in pay.
Well, it is an interim measure until they decide whether to file an indictment or not, on which charges. I wouldn't say this is the end of the line. However, one can safely assume, reflecting on all the different incidents that were investigated and indictments that were solved and what came out of all this, one can assume that even if and when the person is found guilty, his punishment will not be very severe on the one hand, because this is the rule so far. On the other hand, the fact that this action was caught on tape and was, as you say, distributed broadly around the world may make this person an example. Therefore, his punishment might be more severe than what had happened if an investigation was launched without a tape being broadcasted.
And what about settler violence? I know that you all document that as well. When I used to live in the old city of Hebron, we'd oftentimes see very violent acts by the radical settlers that lived within the surrounding area, yet very rarely were they ever prosecuted or arrested or even questioned by the army or the police. How are the statistics in regards to settler violence towards Palestinians?
Well, the statistics are not very different, apparently, in everything to do with law enforcement in the occupied territories and everything to do with Israel's duty to safeguard the rights of the Palestinian, of the local population there. We have recently released a separate data sheet, updating our ongoing monitoring of investigations in the issue of Israeli civilians, settlers or others who attack Palestinians in the West Bank. What we've seen is a very similar picture to what we've seen some 2 years ago when we initially released the figures of our monitoring effort, and that is that some 10% of the investigations do result in an indictment. Or to put it in another way, 90% of the investigations basically fail. And they fail not because the police considered that there was no offense committed, but because the police admit there was an offense, but they either could not locate a suspect or they were not able to gather enough evidence to file an indictment. There is many reasons. Some might attribute it to a lack of motivation by the police officers to investigate settlers. Others may consider the lack of resources committed to the issue of law enforcement in the West Bank as the major reason. But the fact of the matter is that eventually there is no law enforcement or practical law enforcement in the West Bank upon Israeli civilians.
Is this due to the fact that now there's an increasing number of settlers who are in the ranks of the army? Might it be seen that they are being complicit by not addressing these issues or looking the other way?
I must say we don't have any evidence to suggest this. And we're not trying to... we're not looking into intentions. But we are looking at what actually happens on the ground. And what happens on the ground is, as I said, most investigations fail to reach indictments, fail to end with a clear effort to with a clear result saying that the person is paying a price for what he has done. Whether or not or to which extent does the fact that one third of the West Bank police are living in settlements in the West Bank, how deeply the two are connected, I don't feel I can say. The problematic fact is that these investigations fail. As for the reasons for this, there are probably others to speculate upon.
And finally, defending the Army's low indictment rate, an Army spokesperson said it, quote, deploys several methods to examine in a professional manner complaints over offenses against Palestinians, close quote. Lior, your response?
Well, this is part of the project we are leading right now, trying to learn why these investigations fail, why these investigations do not reach indictment. The Army is repeatedly saying that they are doing all they can to investigate these cases, and one can either believe it or not believe it. We are now trying to learn from the investigation files themselves what could have been done and wasn't done. And so if we talk in a few months, I'm sure we'll be happy to share with you our conclusions on the matter.
And we will look forward to that conversation. Our guest has been Lior Yavne, the research director of Yeshdin, an Israeli human rights group dedicated to opposing the ongoing human rights abuses of Palestinians in the occupied territories. Lior Yavne, I want to thank you again for joining us today on Crossing the Line.
Thank you very much.
In Berkeley, I'm Naji Ali, and you're listening to Crossing the Line. While traveling on horseback, on his way to Damascus, a man was struck by a voice and light so powerful that it left him blind. While he groped along the ground trying to find his way, a voice cried out to him, saying, "Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me?" The man Saul was known for unleashing persecution on followers of Christ, known to imprison, torture, and condemn to death those that followed the so-called Messiah. He was greatly feared. But after this Damascus experience, his life completely changed, becoming one of the most well-known and most published of the apostles. This story could be contextualized to talk about our guest today. Thomas R. is an ordained minister in the Presbyterian Church and would often proudly proclaim in his congregation that he was a devout Zionist. Like so many Americans, Reverend R. was duped into believing Israeli propaganda and helped spread that propaganda amongst his congregation. But in 1990, Reverend R. had an awakening for which he credits the Christian canon of St. George Cathedral in Jerusalem and author Mark Ellis, co-editor of the book Beyond Occupation. Realizing that his ignorance of the situation on the ground had made him complicit in great crimes, Reverend R. wrote a book hoping to save others from his mistakes and perhaps in part to make amends. The book is titled Israeli Peace and Palestinian Justice, Liberation Theology and the Peace Process. Reverend Thomas R. joins us from Atlanta. Welcome to Crossing the Line, Reverend R.
Thank you.
Reverend Ark, can you talk a bit about your views and actions prior to having your so-called awakening?
Yes, you know, as a Presbyterian minister, I went with several groups to visit Israel to the Holy Land. And like most other people that go there in groups, we had a Jewish guide and heard a lot of propaganda before we got our suitcases unpacked. We had visited Yad Vashem. We had heard about the Holocaust and how terrible things were for Jews. We saw many, you know, great works in Israel, and the slogan was Israel had turned the desert into a garden. And I saw all that, did not see a Palestinian, did not see another Christian, just saw the holy sites and heard the Jewish story, and came home and just announced to my congregation, you know, marvelous things are taking place there. I am a Zionist. And that was just part of my understanding, as I'm afraid it is of many, many Americans today, mainly because of our media, and goosed on by the Christian right. You know, gosh, what you see on television as being Christian preaching is just unbelievable. Americans, we're good people. Americans are good people, but we are ignorant concerning what's taking place between Israel and the Palestinians and the devastating effect that's having on world peace and on our peace here.
Reverend R., you mentioned that you visited Israel and had received some of the typical tours that they take Christians from America on to show them, like you said, the holy sites, as well as to going to Yad Vashem and other places like that. And you said you didn't happen by to see Palestinian Christians. Were you at all in Bethlehem at this time, or at that time did they take people to Bethlehem, or was it
concerned? Yes, we went to Bethlehem, and we saw Palestinians, but we did not have time for visit, and we certainly did not get into any kind of political conversation. We were well guided. we were herded. And, you know, you develop the herd mentality. You just sort of follow the leader and believe what is said. But then, you know, I backed into a change. As pastor of a church, I taught Bible classes. And we'd studied the book of Exodus. And we just finished that study when a member of the class says, why don't we continue looking at this story of Israel from the 40th chapter of Exodus all the way up to what's happening now. And I can remember saying, well, one reason we don't do that is I don't know that history. But it seemed to be a great degree of interest in the class. And so I thought, well, my land, you know, I can buy a book and stay one paragraph ahead of the class. I've been doing that all my life. And so I went to the bookstore, and that's when I found Naima Teek's book entitled Justice and Only Justice. It's a quote from Deuteronomy from the Old Testament. You know, God wants justice and only justice. And in that book, Teek referenced Mark Ellis, and so I ordered his book, Beyond Occupation. And Naji, that book, It curled my hair, as a saying. You know, it just opened my... I couldn't believe it. And I said, here's a Christian pastor, and I'm trying to be a Christian pastor. I can trust what he says. To buy some time, I thought I would get someone to... other people to speak to the class, and I called the Jewish consulate and asked if they would send someone to talk to us about the Israeli-Palestinian situation, and they sent someone, and then I was looking for something with Palestinian. I found what's called PHRC, that's the Palestinian Human Rights Committee, and I called them. They recommended a man named Jim Jennings, who I think taught archaeology in a university, but anyhow, he came and showed slides. And it just, I'd never seen that before. And I was a little embarrassed. You know, a Presbyterian minister often claims a certain degree of education. Anyhow, this was a history that I did not know, and it was an issue about which, as a Christian pastor, I should have been standing up on the top step screaming my head off, saying, this is not justice, this is not peace, this is not working for the goodwill of the world. It's not even working for the goodwill of Israel. So that sort of started a change in me, and I started reading other books. And then I had the opportunity to go to Israel-Palestine with a small group with Benjamin Weir. Benjamin Weir, some of your listeners will recognize, he was a Presbyterian missionary that had been teaching for decades in Lebanon. And he was captured by the Shiite Muslims and chained to a radiator for about 16 months. And he was released, but he had, you know, he had name recognition, and his name in Israel opened a lot of doors that would have never opened for me. And because of his name, we got into West Bank, and we got into Gaza, and we got to talk to people that if I had just gone on my own, I would never have met and never had an opportunity to hear their stories. And it's then when I came home, I had not thought of writing a book until after I got home. I continued to read. I probably read 200 books on this conflict. And I felt like this is something at least Christian pastors ought to know. Of course, Jewish leaders ought to also, and so should Islamic leaders. You know, we all have a mandate for social justice and for peace.
Reverend R., it's very interesting how you're talking about your conversion, because I happen to come across your book, and as I was reading some of it, you remarked of growing up in the South and being trained as a minister in the South, being reared by a woman who worked for your family for a number of years, and in addition, also going to your seminary, going to other places, realizing that you were allowed into places that African Americans were not allowed into.
Absolutely.
And slowly over time, you realized, you said, this isn't right, this isn't right, as you had remarked in the book. Oftentimes, within this discussion now about Israel-Palestine, people are comparing things to apartheid, or they're comparing them to the Jim Crow laws of the United States. How do you see the comparisons and the contrasts that are now being said about this whole issue?
Well, Jimmy Carter's 100% right. I read his book. If anything, it's a mild book. He had to work to keep from condemning Israel because of its treatment of Palestinians. Anybody, just all you have to do is watch the television. You don't have to have a degree in Middle Eastern history. Look at those settlements. I mean, huge settlements, not just here and there for living, but on the hilltops. And Israel just destroyed the trees and the mountaintops. And I live in the mountains of North Georgia, and the mountains are beautiful. But Israel just bulldozes them down and puts apartment buildings up there. And look at that wall. We don't hear a whole lot of it on television, but that wall is just unbelievable, snaking down through West Bank. It has nothing to do with security. Settlements have nothing to do with security. Home demolitions have nothing to do with security. And uprooting of olive trees has nothing to do with security. The cutting off of medicines and electricity and water in the Gaza certainly is not generating security. There's a big difference over there than here. You know, I go through the airport here, and there are security guards, and they want to check, and they ask me to take off my shoes. But without exception, they are courteous. They tell us that, you know, we're putting you through this little hassle for your own safety and security, and have a good trip. But over there, the checkpoints and security, their number one goal seems to be just to humiliate and intimidate the Palestinians. And it's a whole different setup over there. And the thing we have to do here, we have to be more vocal. We need to write more to our media, to the TV stations, and say, give us balanced news. Americans are good people, and we'd do the right thing if we knew, but we do not know. Check out ifamericansknew.com. And the lady, her name's also named Weir, no kin to Benjamin Weir, Allison Weir. She's a Californian, too. And she started this program of just looking at the statistics of Israel's treatment of the Palestinians and Palestinian reaction to Israel. And these are figures that my neighbors don't know. So all I can do, you know what I do, I get DVDs. Powerful DVD by John Pelger entitled Palestine is Still the Issue. And sometimes some people think I'm arrogant, but we invite friends up to our house for dinner. We live in the mountains, and I say, by the way, as soon as we finish eating dinner, I've got a DVD I want you to watch. And I make them sit there and watch it, and they say, I've never seen anything like this. I've never heard of anything like this. There's a DVD called The Iron Wall, The Iron Wall by Muhammad Alater. Powerful little DVD. It's only 50 minutes long, but it gives an enormous amount of information that we cannot see on television. We can read a little bit in the print media about the settlements and the wall and the home demolitions. And, gosh, you know, Americans don't even know about the USS Liberty. Most Americans never heard of Rachel Khoury. It's sad how we are manipulated by the media. And then join that to the Christian right, it's amazing.
Well, Reverend R., I want to go back to something. After your awakening, and when you started to realize that there was an imbalance, not only of the media, but also of justice happening within Israel, Palestine. And when you went back and started preaching sermons to your congregation, what was the reaction mm-hmm. that you received? I remember reading something about that in your book, that it was pretty much a split. Some people were shocked and felt that you were lying, and others felt that, you know, they, as you said, had never heard about this. What was the reaction?
Mm-hmm. Well, I had been at Najee 20 years in that same church. You know, I had made a lot of hospital visits. I had buried people, made a lot of pastoral calls. You know, I had a relationship with the people in the church. And most people opted to keep that relationship. It was a shock. Of course, I had a small crew. I preached about three sermons in which I opposed the first invasion of Iraq, you know, or Desert Storm by Bush Sr. And I had some people, come to church with American flags sticking up out of their coat pocket. Now, I'm not talking about a 2-inch flag. I'm talking about a 10-inch flag. And they'd come and sit right in front of me, you know. And it was hard for people to hear, still is. It's hard for people to hear someone question the policies of the government without turning that into, you're not supporting our troops and you're not patriotic. I had a small crew of that. I also, because of my appreciation for Mark Ellis, who is a very prolific Jewish writer, and Naeem Ateek, I raised some funds, and we invited both of those men to come to our church to do a workshop, a five-night workshop. And both agreed to come. And some people in the Jewish community started calling some of my elders, who, you know, they are the bosses of the church, and said, you know, Jews and Christians have worked so well together in Atlanta. We've built Habitat houses. And all that's true. And they said, you know, your pastor is anti-Semitic and he's going to destroy that relationship. And at least one of my elders was called and told that if we continued to go with this workshop, they would picket the church. Well, those elders, my church, like everybody else's church, we fly so close to stall speed financially until they said, ooh, if we upset some people and they quit coming to church, it'll affect our income. And so they withdrew the invitation to Atik and Ellis. And that upset me greatly. And I had a confrontation with the session and said, you know, what you're saying is you no longer trust my leadership. But we had those two men coming. I moved to another church, and it was amazing. We had about 45, 50 people the first night, and we had 145 the last night. Both were wonderful and both experienced and both knew exactly what they were talking about. And it was an epiphany for a lot of people. But I stayed on in the church, and I left the church when my wife's father got sick, and we moved to Pennsylvania to be close to him. But it was a good church, and of course I went into what was called interim work, which meant I served a church between pastors, and I taught in every church I served, there's probably 8 or 10 of them. I taught classes on Israel-Palestine. And there's always a small segment of people that are energetic and say, we've got to educate our friends. We've got to stand up for justice and do what we can to make a change in this. But the vast majority, for a long time, just as soon not be bothered. You know, we've got other things to worry about. And so it's easy to say, it's a lot of hyperbole, you know, and exaggeration, and that's just Tom's bug. And so as an interim, they knew I was not going to be around long, so they didn't have to shoot me. They knew they were going to outlive me. But it's, you know, it's a tough job. We're facing a biased media and a very, very powerful Christian right that just thinks somehow God stepped out in the 12th chapter of Genesis and made a divine donation of land to the Jews as though we had a suitcase full of virgin territory in which nobody lived and says, here, I want you to have it. And to show that history differently is difficult.
Well, that actually leads me into my next question, Reverend R. You're talking about the Christian right and their influence on not only this current administration, but also with their strong support for the State of Israel. And, of course, I'm talking specifically about Christians United for Israel, or CUFI, which is headed up by the Reverend John Hagee, as well as Rod Parsley, and a number of others who actively support them, such as T.D. Jakes, Fred Price, and the like. Sir, do you feel right at the moment that this is a huge movement, or is this a smaller segment of the evangelical community? There's been a big debate amongst especially those within the media saying that it is this huge movement. But in fact, I've heard from a number of other people, such as Don Wagner, who teaches at North Park University, who's been on the show in the past, who have said that it is a small segment. What are your thoughts?
Well, I'm afraid it's growing. You know, I listened to John Hagee. I just can't believe him, man. This guy, Jack Van Impe, is, you know, just as radical. This whole rapture theology business is just not based on Scripture. They pull a little image here and a little image there and put their own interpretation on it, and they draw these huge charts. And they speak with such certainty. And it just amazes me when I look out and see the thousands of people that those folks draw into their circle. I'm scared of them. And they have to be dealt with theologically. And the mainline church is sort of, taken the position, well, we'll ignore it and it'll go away. And I think we have passed that point. I think the mainline church is going to have to pull out its theology and say, you know, this is not what the Bible says. The Bible speaks about justice. In fact, I told a group, I spoke to a group not too far from here recently, and I said, you know, ours is a God of justice. I said, if you know that about God, and you don't know anything else about God, you'll know more about God if you know everything else there is to know about God and don't know that. Ours is a God of justice. And, you know, we talk about the differences between Judaism and Christianity and Islam, and how can we work together when we have such different theology. But the one thing that we all three have is a mandate for social justice. And, you know, we ought to pull ourselves together and work to fulfill that mandate. And after we cross that hurdle and after we solve that problem, then we can look at our different theologies. But the basic theology we have is justice. But we live on myths. The Greek word for truth, if I understand this, I'm not a scholar, is aletheia. Aletheos means to forget. Aletheos means to not forget, like agnostic means you don't know, you know. To not forget what actually happened. To not forget the real history. For when we forget the real history, we make up myths. You know, a good example of that is the story about how the Bible came to us. It's a very, very shaky document. And I hear people say, ours is a Christian nation. You have to forget a heck of a lot of history to believe that. Zionism is built on a myth. You know, a people without a land for a land without a people is a total myth on both sides.
Reverend R., final thoughts while we're wrapping up this interview.
Well, I just think Americans need to read and we need to Google. We need to get on the Internet and dig out the truth, the real history and what's taking place. And I think we will do the just thing. I think Palestinians are absolutely in shock that America has not lived up to its own principles about justice. And we say it every time we stand up, liberty and justice for all. And they wonder what that really means to us, the way we have financed Israel's abuse of Palestinians.
The book is Israeli Peace, Palestinian Justice, Liberation Theology and the Peace Process, published by Clarity Press and written by the Reverend Thomas R., a retired Presbyterian minister, former Christian Zionist, who is now actively working to bring about justice and peace to Palestinians as well as Israelis. Reverend Thomas R., I'd like to thank you first for your courage and also for joining us today on Crossing the Line.
Thank you so very much.
You have been listening to Crossing the Line, which is produced by members of the Podcast Collective at the studios of 94.1 KPFA Radio in Berkeley, California. Special thanks to news producer Ghassan Banura, segment producer Ali Budner, contributing producers Mumia Abu-Jamal, Rami Almagari, Scott Berguin, Quiva Butterly, and Nora Barrows-Friedman. From all of us here, we thank you so much for your continued support. In Berkeley, this is Naji Ali for Crossing the Line. Signing off.